Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio, FM 104.6. We are chatting art, transport, communications and history. That's CATCH, it's the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful geeky subjects as myself and the excellent guests. In this edition, how railway workers in Ukraine fix their system after attacks. Could you get to Azerbaijan by train? And how 10 talented writers were brought together to tell their railway tales. Today we're joined live from Kiev by Channel 4 news journalist Felicity Spector and by CarbonJack.com creator Jack Curtis. Welcome both to the Catchcast.
Hey Mark.
Thanks so much for being here, both of you. You're both contributors to a new book out this month which features never-before-heard tales of train travel and railway history. But I wonder if we can start by just taking you both back a little bit and ask how you got interested in railways. Maybe we can start with Felicity first, please.
Well, I have to say I never really travelled by train as a child because it was much too expensive. We used to go camping and stuff with my parents when I was a child in the car. It was kind of unheard of to take a train anywhere. I mean, I can't drive myself. I did pass my test, but that was right before I went to work in Moscow back in the early 90s. And driving there was a complete nightmare, so I never drove again. So since then, I've been reliant on trains, and they do vary very much across the various different places I've gone to. But it's always a very reliable way to get from A to B as long as they work.
And Jack, you came to love railways more as your life progressed, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. So I think it was more from looking into alternative forms of transport, what might be the sustainable option to get to certain places, and kind of discovering that there are all these wonderful rail networks and European trains and trains around the UK that you can get to, and you can kind of go and see places that you wouldn't do normally and have a bit of adventure along the way. Although I did grow up near the Bluebell Railway as a child, which is this little steam engine railway in Sussex. Maybe I subconsciously took it on earlier than I thought.
You breathed it into your soul by having a steam train running around the back.
Yeah.
Well, look, we'll come to discuss more about what inspired both of your contributions to this new book in a bit, but I'd like to find out a bit more about both of your lives before getting to the book. Maybe we can start with Jack this time. I understand you spent some time at the Treasury.
Yes, so before I started my environmental business, where I run now, I was a civil servant in the Treasury for a few years, working on all sorts of stuff. It was in the kind of post-Brexit era, so a lot of the stuff was related to that and trade negotiations and the rest of it. So quite different to catching the train.
And do you have the feeling that the Treasury are necessarily that big fans of rail transport?
I think that in general in this country, there's been a little bit of a problem with the approach to infrastructure over the last few years and sort of how long it takes and actually just kind of getting ahead and getting on with it. I read a statistic a while ago that some of the countries in Europe, like Spain, has over 4,000 kilometres of high-speed rail. France, I think it's 3,000. And I think in the UK, we're about 100 kilometres. So I think there probably are some sort of issues with our approach to railways and infrastructure.
And Felicity, please do tell us more about your career. I believe I'm right in saying 36 years as a journalist must have been absolutely packed full of drama.
Well, yes, it's had its moments. I've always worked at ITN, at Channel 4 News. I joined them, well, I was student union president at Oxford, and after that, I decided never to go into politics after a year of student politics. That was definitely enough for me. So I joined ITN at that point. And yeah, it's been really fascinating. I mean, it's never dull. Everything, a day is always different. It's always very busy and usually not the most uplifting content that we deal with every day. But I particularly have enjoyed specialising in, first of all, I was in the USSR before that all fell apart. And then I went to Eastern Europe quite a lot, to Prague and to various Wall of the Berlin Wall and so on. And then covering the rise of the far right the first time around in the 1990s and people like Berlusconi. So yeah, it was very, very interesting. And then I went off to America. I did a master's degree at Harvard as a mid-career student and with a Fulbright scholarship to pay for it, which was very fortunate because they're not cheap, American universities. But after that, I was able to cover American elections and book all the guests to come on and write the content and stuff for our programs from Washington during all the elections from 2000 up until 2016. So that was also a really fascinating glimpse into a completely different political system.
So I'm gathering from that you did your academic or some of your academic studies a bit later in your life. I did also, I recently did a master's in railway studies, but I'm wondering about whether academia takes public transport very seriously. What do you think?
My first degree was at Oxford, so That was a long time ago, and Oxford doesn't do anything that's very contemporary. Well, it certainly didn't then. Harvard, I went to the Kennedy School of Government, and they do a lot of work on infrastructure and on public services, although America itself doesn't have a particularly good network of public transport because they're so dominated by cars. I mean, you can take the Amtrak from Washington to New York, but unless you pay a huge amount for this high-speed service, it takes absolutely hours, and it's only over a couple of hundred miles. It takes all day to get there. And if the fast train is in front, it takes precedence. So the one behind, the sort of second class slow train, is held back for the fancy people in the fast train. So it's not the most user-friendly system I've ever come across.
Yeah, Jack, I think you've taken some trains in America as well. What's your view of the system over there?
I think it's a great shame that the system there isn't stronger, because it's such an epic country in terms of the vastness of scenery and the different towns and cultures you can go through. And, you know, there's a bit of a tradition of the long American road trip, but I think the long American train trip would be just as fascinating. There are a couple of Amtrak cross-country routes you can take. But yeah, I mean, it kind of blows my mind that you can't get more easily between some of these cities, certainly up and down each of the coasts, by train, and you have to fly. I mean, flying in between these cities is just sort of second nature to everyone getting around. They wouldn't even contemplate taking the train. So I think that's a real great shame.
It is a shame, isn't it, when you think about the history of the United States, basically the whole of the inland area that isn't obviously available by the sea or by a river was developed by the railways. It had the biggest railway system in the world, and now look at it.
Yeah, it's a great shame. And I think it might make the country feel a bit more connected as well. And because I think often it feels like a lot of disparate parts that are very separate and people don't often go to. And I mean, everyone flies. The flows flights are pretty expensive. They're intra-country flights. So I think it would help connect everyone a bit more.
I certainly remember getting once you were able to buy from outside the United States a kind of $200 ticket to travel as much as you wanted on trains for, you know, 2 weeks or whatever. And I was going to see various friends and weddings and things like that. And I went up and down. It was all on the East Coast, down as far as Charleston and back to Washington and Boston. It wasn't the most comfortable. To buy a kind of sleeper carriage was phenomenally expensive. So you have to sit in a sort of allegedly reclining seat that does what would blind about a centimetre and a half and then springs back upright the minute you sort of move slightly. And also they came round. It was an overnight from Washington to Charleston. And they said, do you want a blanket? It's $8. And I was like, oh no, it's boiling outside. And then suddenly the air conditioning just ramped up and it was absolutely freezing. And then I missed the chance to buy a blanket. And oh, it was so cold. I had to sort of, because it was summer, I'm trying to sort of put two t-shirts across my shoulders to just warm up a bit. It was terrible. I didn't prepare very well for that journey, obviously.
Oh, that crazy American air conditioning. It can be so, so chilly. And there needs to be a little bit of disclosure here before we go on, because one of the 10 essays in this book is actually written by me.
You've been outed, Mark.
Do you mind if I just share something with you? Both of your stories are just so gripping, and we will come to hear more about them. But when I was approached to contribute my story, I just didn't know what to write.
So what happened? How did you decide?
Well, I just wrote about what I knew, which was about being a nerdy kid collecting train maps.
Why not?
After these maps. Yeah, it's cray cray.
So let's get into each of your stories. Felicity, may I start with you, please? You focus on your recent experiences in the Ukraine. There's entries right up until June this year, so it's all very current. The very early evacuation of the country from the east by train, that's something that's not really been discussed. I haven't seen it on any other media. How did all that happen?
Well, Ukraine is a really vast country. I think people don't necessarily realise that. It's hundreds and hundreds of miles across, and all the frontline areas at the beginning of the full-scale war, well, I mean, the Russian troops were coming almost as far as Kyiv, but there were certainly a lot of areas where people needed to be evacuated in a hurry, women and children. Men, of course, had to stay behind because of the martial law. So it was a really chaotic, it could have been an incredibly chaotic situation because the roads were very clogged up, even if people did have cars. So the railways took charge and basically just organised these evacuations. Very great numbers of people from places like Kharkiv and from Kyiv and from all the eastern cities across Slavyansk and a lot of places now where the trains don't operate because of the war. But at that point, they could take huge numbers of people and just put doubled number of people into the carriages. People could only really take one bag with them. So it was, you know, and it was really sad pictures of children sort of waving goodbye to their dads as the train Ukraine's left for the West. But they did get millions of people to either to the west of Ukraine or to Western European countries like Poland, where a lot of people went initially to get some sanctuary from what was happening.
Crikey. You write very vividly about the human casualties of this long conflict. What effect has that had on the railway operator? I can't pronounce the name of it. You write it in the book. Yes. Can you help me?
Zaliznitsa. Yeah. So Zaliznitsa means railway and Ukra is obviously for Ukraine. Yeah, they've been an incredible company because they basically said in the time of war, people have to be able to rely on basic services like the railways to be able to take them either to safety or to wherever they need to go. And so they decided that they would just make the trains run on time. And Alexander Kamishin, who was then the head of Zaliznitsa, he was a very dynamic young business guy. And he just said, right, we're just going to do everything we can. We'll operate like a kind of military service almost. And they all lived in this command train, the five sort of main executives, and moved around the country all the time. And partly because they were on a Russian hit list, but also because they wanted to make sure that they were visiting all the places where the trains were, you know, under great stress, and so that they could reassure the staff that they were sort of, you know, on their side and were with them. And I haven't got enough praise for it. They're just incredible people, the staff of the railway company. Still to this day, I travelled yesterday from Sumy in the east to Kyiv. It's a very risky train line. It goes very, very close to the Russian border, to two villages which have been evacuated since May because they're so dangerous. There are FPV drones, which are these small drones which drop explosives onto people's cars. So the roads aren't safe at all. The road from Sumy to Bilopilia, for example, they'd said, no, please don't drive down this road. So the train is really the only service that people can take if they need to get to and from this village. But it's still, you know, just a few miles from the Russian border. And the staff that go on that train every day, three times a day there's a train, they have to just, you know, go through these areas where most people would think, my goodness, you know, I wouldn't go anywhere near somewhere like that.
Because presumably the trains are targets as well.
Yeah, they're incredibly professional. And a lot of train staff have very unfortunately been killed in Russian strikes. They often have these double taps where, you know, once repair workers have come to mend damage on a line, they'll then drop another device, which, you know, it's just really awful. So, you know, I have huge amounts of respect and praise for the railway company and the staff.
You call them the iron people.
Exactly, yes, because, you know, and a lot of them are women now because obviously, you know, large numbers of men are in the armed forces. So a lot of the staff, not so much the drivers, although they did say they were training women up to be drivers, but certainly all the conductors and a lot of the station staff are women. And they're definitely people who are very professional, but they don't take any nonsense. So you can imagine that they would be incredibly good in a crisis situation. There have been a number of times that I've read about it's train stations coming under attack and the staff have to move everybody very quickly into a bomb shelter because every station is equipped with a shelter. And the other day I was traveling in Kyiv, for example, when there was a huge strike on the government building. You may have seen it on the news, the first time that a Russian missile has hit the main central government building. On the way to the station, we could see the smoke clouds from the explosion that had happened. I got to the station, the main building was closed because they don't want lots of people milling about in a building that could be a target. So everybody was directed very calmly down to the tunnels and all the departures were on time. I got my train to Kharkiv at 6:45, about 45 minutes after this attack had happened. There was still an air alarm in progress, but the train was on time and got to the destination on time. So you can't really imagine that from the world of British railways where they sort of, you know, everything shuts down for hours if there's a few leaves on the track. But yeah, the Ukrainian railways are very resilient.
This is incredible to hear that even during such challenging circumstances, the trains can still run on time.
Absolutely. I mean, they do have, you know, Mr. Kamishin, when he was very active on Twitter when he was heading the railway company. So he got a lot of people interested in the work of the railway, which is when I first started getting interested in them and really impressed by what they were doing. And his motto was keep running. And he was very determined about it. He said, whatever else happens, if there's an attack, we'll just fix it. We'll move on. We won't delay the trains. People need to get to their, you know, their destinations. And we're going to make sure that happens, you know, come what may. We don't put people at risk. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're very quick to fix things. And, you know, they have lots of plan Ds. If this track is damaged, we can go this way and take the train to a slightly different route. So they have a lot of clever contingency planning for every eventuality. It's a very sort of crisis management operated system for obvious reasons, but they've also tried to invest in new trains and new tracks and so on, and trying to integrate the Ukrainian railways with the rest of Europe, because that's one of the legacies of the old Soviet system, is that the gauge is different. I don't know much about the technicalities of it, but it means that you have to get off and wait for them to change something over at the border and so on. So they want to make that system much smoother, so the trains can just run into Western Europe without having to stop and delay people.
Crikey, I don't understand how they can do so well with operating it under such difficult circumstances. And Jack, you could have done with a bit of that strong punctuality in some of your trips, eh?
Oh, no, completely. It wasn't even just that the trains were late on my trip, so we didn't even know how late they were because there weren't even proper signs up. But it sounds like, I mean, Fissy Chaps is an extraordinary read. It feels so surreal when you see, when she writes about passengers getting on and checking their apps to see if there are incoming missiles to their location as they're kind of just getting on the train. It's quite extraordinary to read about.
We're still with two contributors to a new compendium of train travel tales. It's called The Untold Railway Stories, and it's out this month. Jack, the Ukrainian railway staff seems so determined to keep their services running against all odds, but your story relates to a journey that was altogether quite different, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, it was a little bit mad and entirely by choice. With my two friends, my two co-founders, we decided to see if we could get all the way from London to Baku in Azerbaijan by train without taking any flights to attend the COP29 climate conference. And we did it, but it took us 2 weeks. It was about 6,000 kilometres, went through 10 different countries. I think it was 15 trains in total. And we even managed to get across the Azerbaijan land border by foot, which is still to this day closed. So yeah, it was quite an adventure.
Did you ever come across such tenacity as Felicity has been describing in Ukraine for rail workers overcoming adversity and being so helpful?
It's hard to compare anything to some of the extraordinary stuff in Felicity's chapter, but we did encounter some amazing people. Well, there were some difficult rail workers in terms of some of the ticket checks, but there were some incredibly helpful ones as well that got us through some dark moments where we didn't know when trains were coming. But it was actually, I think it was often the people, some of the other passengers we met, because we were taking routes that were not sort of typical routes that we would be on or that you would see a lot of kind of tourists, so to speak, on. And there were lots of kind of locals taking these trains and were just really wanting to talk to us, tell us about their country, share their local snacks with us, find out what we were doing. And that was like, well, that was one of the best parts, actually.
It must have taken an inordinate amount of planning to take so many trains across so many countries.
It did. It was, I don't want to say military operation from what we just heard, but I felt like I was doing military operation in the moment. Because the thing is that every country has their own booking system. So it takes a while to get your head around network rail and bookings in this country and different operators. And then you've got that by country, different languages, Google Translate can only get you so far. And then there's also the fact that some of the tickets have to be bought in person and a lot of them sell out immediately. So there were a lot of close coordination with people on the ground in different countries and ticket bookers. I think we got off the station in Bucharest at one point, met a man, he said, I'll be wearing a red raincoat, and gave us some tickets that we booked in advance for the next train, and then never seen him again. So yeah, it was quite a logistical operation.
Oh crikey, that must have been heart-stopping.
Yeah, I was very nervy the whole time about the ticket system, because I'd done a lot of booking, so I was worried that something would go wrong. And we did almost get kicked off a train once because it was a sort of a joint Romanian and Hungarian operated train, and the Romanian ticket inspector didn't accept our tickets, and we had to plead with the Hungarian ticket inspector, who did accept our tickets, but the Romanian inspector wasn't so happy about it. But we got through that.
Crikey, I would have been a nervous wreck. You both write so evocatively. I was right with you on some of those border crossings, my heart in my hand. But I really especially love how you say that the rail maps, being a guy that's written about railway maps, they make it all look so easy. But is it?
I did think about that as well reading your chapter, because there is quite a lot of growth in sleeper trains and European train routes at the moment, and you see a lot of maps showing all these new routes that are popping up that say they can take you from the west of Europe all the way to the east. And it looks like, you know, you're looking at a whole continent and beyond often. They make it look like the tube map, like you write about, which is kind of quite frictionless within a city, but then you get these kind of these train networks, and actually the border crossings can have a bit more friction than you expect. And I think it's maybe going in the other direction with the way that some people are approaching borders and how they police those borders. And we went for a lot of ticket inspections, and ticket inspectors coming on the trains and taking your passports. And it was quite unexpected, because you just kind of hear the headline, oh, European train travel's on the rise, there are all these sleeper trains take you across Europe. And the reality is, it's a little bit different in terms of how frictionless those borders are.
I'm going to try and bring Felicity back on this one as well, because for one of the other books I did about railway maps, I remember finding a map, and this is the important date to remember, from 1936, which looked like a tube map. And it looked like you could literally get from Brindisi to Budapest without changing trains or anything. But it was the problem of the gauge, this difference between the size of the tracks that was the problem. And you really can't do a seamless journey right across Europe even now, can you?
No, I mean, it depends on which way I come, but usually I go through, because obviously you can't fly into Ukraine during the full-scale war, so you have to get a plane to somewhere in Poland or Romania or Moldova or somewhere, and then either a bus or a train. But there are plenty of trains from Poland, but you have to change at one of the border crossings. And I usually go through a place called Przemyśl, which is an absolute nightmare, because you have to get off the Polish train, then stand around in a horrible car park, and it's always 11 at night for 2 hours. They won't open the customs. There's no disabled access, or old ladies with suitcases have got to struggle up a load of steps and things. They don't make it easy. And then when you finally get through to the Ukrainian side, you're then to wait by the side of the train until that opens. So it's a long old process that if you could just stay on the same train, it would be a lot easier. I was invited to the railway museum in Kharkiv the other day. They were very keen to show me that. In fact, I think they opened it specially for me. They certainly opened the cafe for me and made special cookies, which was really lovely. But they had this old train map on the wall before the illegal annexation of Crimea, showing all the train routes which, you know, used to exist before the Russian invasion. And in the main train station in Kyiv, they have a timetable, a sort of painted on timetable, with all the destinations that they want to restore to all the cities that are currently under occupation. And so far only Kherson has been restored, but they're hoping for all that the way to Sevastopol by train would be ideal, really.
Yeah, a big task. Now, coming back to Jack, you had a few hours off in between trains sometimes. Can you tell us about some of the sort of delightful places you discovered along your route?
Yeah, this is why I think I've come to love some of these sort of journeys, and it happens on road trips, because you end up stopping at places that you might not look at a map and pick as a holiday destination, but you end up stopping there, and there wonderful places. I think probably the most interesting was a place called Veliko Tarnovo in Bulgaria, which I'm reliably informed by the internet was the ancient sort of historical capital. It's an amazing place. It's quite hard to explain in a way, but it kind of is this, it's sort of up on these different cliffs or hilltops with a river, the Yantra River, running through the middle of it. And on one, you have this sort of old town restaurants. Then you have this old sort of fort on the other one in the distance, that's sort of lit up with lights. And then there's a kind of a wooded park on the other. And the views are just amazing. And I never would have found myself there otherwise. And then I think the other place that was just kind of quite fascinating, I never would have gone to, was, so I loved going to Georgia in general on the journey, and Tbilisi was great, but Batumi, the sort of city on the coast, which is where we went to just crossing the border from Turkey, it was sort of fascinating, because it was kind of, on the one hand, it was part sort of Vegas style casino city, Dubai style skyscrapers. Parts of the seafront were a bit like kind of an old school British seaside town like Blackpool, and then also had this amazing old town that was very authentically Georgian, with amazing restaurants and food. And it was just a eclectic mix of people. It's got a botanical garden next to a casino. It was just kind of fascinating. So there were loads of places like that along the way.
Sounds absolutely incredible when you've gone through so many different territories. I wonder if you would ever consider a role swap, you two. Jack, would you tackle a Ukrainian rail journey? Felicity, would you fancy a 6,000 kilometer train trek through 10 countries?
I think this would sound fascinating. I think I might have to get a bit more hardy, considering the things I got nervy about on my train journey. But I've been fascinated by it, when you've heard stories of some of the political leaders sort of entering almost secretly by train into Ukraine during the war. But I'm sure it would be fascinating.
I have to say, one thing about Ukrainian railways is that their ticket booking system is incredibly easy. You have the app, put the app on your phone. You have to have a Ukrainian phone number, but that's easy to get.
So in that case,
You can return the tickets if you don't want to go, if you want another one. The only problem with it is that there's often no tickets available on the time or the route you want because people have sort of speculated on them and there's a bit of a black market, which I can't comment on. But so sometimes it's slightly frustrating, but otherwise very efficient. But I got one train a few weeks ago, 17-hour, the Lviv to Kherson train. And I'm like, okay, that's the longest train ride I ever want to take. I was really ready to get off, but I don't have any food on Ukrainian trains. They do on some of the intercities, but on the main overnight trains, you can just get a cup of tea. So I do actually quite fancy these dining cars. It sounds really nice. So nothing like a train dining car. So that kind of journey where you could just sort of sail through some beautiful sort of down to this location with, you know, some lovely service in a dining car, that I could get on board with, definitely.
Maybe we can do these things in luxury, but I think I'm a bit too risk averse to tackle either of your amazing stories. I'll probably settle for a look around Vicky Pipe's Station Gardens or Andrew Martin's trip to the seaside in Britain. Those are two of the other contributors to the Untold Railway Stories. There's also tales from Borneo, Dar es Salaam, Syria, Nairobi and Myanmar, plus the incredible construction of tracks between Chicago and the Pacific, escaping a Nazi transport train, and some oddball guy who writes about his childhood obsession of subway maps. So huge thanks to Jack Curtis and Felicity Spector for joining us on the Catchcast. Thank you both.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
It's been very good indeed, and I'm glad that the line held out for both of those. Hope you enjoyed listening as much as I have. The Untold Railway Stories is edited by Monisha Rajesh. It's just out now from Duckworth Books. It'll be on your favourite search engine. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting, art, transport, communications and history. Please join us then.